The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Okay, now you have in your hand Matthew chapter 1. If you've ever been involved in a church, I know some of us will be, some of us may not be, but if you're on the Bible reading roster, this is the one you don't want to get, okay? 50 names, one after another. Now, how do you make sense of it? What's it all about? My guess is, if you're like me, you turn a if you do read the Bible, and I hope we might motivate you if you don't, you turn to Matthew chapter 1 and you look at the beginning and go, down to verse 18 where we start talking about Joseph and Mary, and you skip over it. But the question is, why has Matthew gone to all the trouble to give you 50 names, around about 50 names, one after that? What's the point of that? Well, let's see if in the 13 minutes I've got left, let's see if we can explain that, okay? In your hand, printed out the whole chapter, on one side you've got the genealogy, in the old translations of the Bible, the begatting, Abraham begat Isaac, etc. And then on the other side, you've got the up, if you like, that's the long view. Turn the page, the second half of the chapter is the up close and personal view about Joseph and Mary, two young people caught up in events that I just think they couldn't have understood just how big bigger thing was getting started as the baby is born. So let's see if we can make sense of it. Let me show you, what is it? I just want to show you eight words, and you see the amount of information that comes with each of these words as we put them up. Okay, here we go. Donald Bradman. Okay. Donald Trump. Different set of information jumps into your head. Donald Sutherland. And last of all, Don Adams. Now, I asked Lachlan this morning, he didn't know who Don Adams is. Obviously, he's under 40. Anyone know who Don Adams is? Yes, sir?
Get Smart.
Get Smart, that's right. Maxwell Smart. All right. But with each of the Dons, a very, whole different kind of set of mental images jump into your head. Well, let's try it with the ladies. Mary McKillop, Britney Spears, Kim Kardashian, Mother Teresa, Julie Bishop. Now, there's 10 words. They're not just a whole different set of random words. Everything about the person and their life, everything you know, kind of flashes up when you hear their name. It encompasses who they are. Now, if you're a Bible reader, or if you're used to reading the Old Testament, for example, when you read in that genealogy, Abraham, Jacob, David, Bathsheba, Ruth, everything about those stories is there and kind of flashes up in your mind. So it's Matthew's way of kind of giving us 2,000 years of Old Testament history in half a page. Now, if you look, what's he done? Where has he begun? Right? Or you can now on the screen or in your hand. He said this. This is the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Very quickly, the Messiah is the Hebrew way of talking about God's great king who is coming, the one who's promised throughout the Old Testament. That's the Hebrew way of saying it. The Greek word for it is Christ. So Jesus Christ or Jesus the Messiah, same thing, just different languages. In English, you might say the anointed one or the special one, the chosen one. And notice he says two names there, David and Abraham. Just to very quickly say, about 1,000 years before Jesus, God said to King David, the greatest king of ancient Israel, God promised David that someone would rule on his throne, one of his descendants would be king forever. And 1,000 years before that, 2000 BC, God promised Abraham that somehow through Abraham's family, which is the genealogy, through Abraham's family, the whole world would be blessed. He would affect the whole world. And so that's the story. Now, how do you make sense of it? Have a look at verse 17. It's not just a random group of names. Matthew tells us how to understand what he's done. Thus, there were 14 generations in all from Abraham to David, 14 from David to the exile, to Babylon, and 14 from the exile to the Messiah. If you want to understand the birth of Jesus, you can get the whole of the Old Testament in three sections, is what he's done. Now, I know he's deliberately done this because he's actually left out particular... he's left people out to make it three lots of 14. You might like to... You can ask later on why the number 14, should you wish. We know from Luke's Gospel, in some of those sections, there were 21 people mentioned. Now, it's not cheating because the begatting word, the word for is the father of, can mean grandfather, great-grandfather, whatever, like the ancestor of. So what's he saying? There's three sections, really, if you want to understand the Old Testament history and the promise of the coming king. The first one you might say on the way up, verses 2 to 6, goes from Abraham about 2000 BC and kind of builds the nation up to David about 1000 BC, where God promises Abraham to make him into a great nation, to bless the whole world, to give him the promised land. That section shows all of those. You end up with David king in the promised land and the nation. Now, Matthew does something unusual, and that is he mentions women in the genealogy. Now, that doesn't seem unreasonable, does it? I mean, women are definitely involved in the whole process, but it's unusual for the ancient world. The girls didn't usually get a jumper, right? Get a mention. But what he does is unusual, and that is he doesn't mention the good girls. So he doesn't mention Sarah, Rebecca, Leah, Rachel. He actually mentions the girls who are, well, here they are. You can see the four. Tamar. By the way, these pictures are just random, okay? We don't know what the girls looked like. Tamar, in Genesis 38, sleeps with her father-in-law in order to have a son, and that's an interesting story. Rahab, does anyone know Rahab's job? A prostitute in Jericho. Ruth, now it's not that Ruth did anything wrong, but her family background is a tribe of Moab, which came from the incestuous relationship of Abraham's nephew, and that's a kind of a sad story. And then last of all is Bathsheba, who was Uriah's wife that King David committed adultery with. Now, why mention these four women? At one level, three out of the four are Gentiles. They're not Jewish, and they've been brought into Israel. And Matthew will finish his gospel in chapter 28, and we might get there by Christmas time. He'll finish his gospel in chapter 28 with Jesus telling his disciples to go to all the world and make disciples, all the world, and tell them about him. So right from the beginning, God's been bringing non-Israelites in to hear about him. But the other reason may be this, and I think this is more likely, each of these girls has a, how would you put it, these women, a whiff of scandal about them. It's not their fault, usually, they've been mistreated by men. It's not their fault, but there's a whiff of scandal around them. And there's also a whiff of scandal around the fifth woman in the genealogy. Anyone pick who the fifth woman might be? Mary, at the end. Now, from the very beginning, there's been talk of a scandal around the birth of Jesus. And perhaps Matthew is showing that right from the beginning in his family line, there's been this kind of allegations of scandal, I guess, would you say? By the way, someone this morning asked a question. He's picked these girls. Are you saying that the men aren't scandalous? Or, you know, right? Most of the men are completely useless and have feet of clay, just like me. Just he happened to pick these women as well. So that's the way up. Now, when you get to after King David, things begin to fall apart. So, all right, we're really going to have to go. After King David, at about 1000 BC, there's King Solomon and all his wealth and wisdom. Solomon has a son called Rehoboam. And I guess to put it in colloquial language, Rehoboam is a complete muppet. Within a few days, he divides the kingdom, there's civil war later, it's a complete mess. And so the nation ends up divided, things are very messy. David's dynasty rules the south, Judah, there's 10 tribes in the north, and eventually by 600 BC, Babylon comes, conquers Jerusalem and takes them into exile. It's a very sad story. Now about 80 or so years later, in dribs and drabs, they come back, and from 500-600 BC, That's the third section until the birth of Jesus. Now, I grew up in Grafton, up on the north coast, and when some of my peers, some of the other young guys there, became carpenters or were doing an apprenticeship, the older guys that they were working with would send them to the hardware store to get a long wait. And so they'd go to the counter and they'd say to the guy in the hardware store, "I'm here for a long wait, please." And the guy would say, "Okay," and go out the back or whatever, leave them for half an hour. And at the end, they'd come back and say, "You've had your wait, you can go now, thanks." All right. Section 3 is all about a long wait. And really, from 500 or so BC to the birth of Jesus, they're conquered. The nation is conquered by the Greeks and then the Seleucids and then the Romans, and very little happens. But what Matthew's showing is, through all of that history, God's kept those promises to Abraham to bless the whole world and to David that the great king was coming. God's kept them alive. And if you want to understand the history, something new is happening. Now, how's it happening new? Well, you turn the page and you turn over to 18 to 20, verse 18, and you've got the up close and personal side of the birth of Jesus, right? The personal story. So have a look at verse 18. This is how the birth of Jesus the Messiah came about. His mother Mary was pledged to be married to Joseph, but before they came together, she was found to be pregnant through the Holy Spirit. To be betrothed in those days carried as much legal weight as being married. Betrothal might last a year. She's become pregnant and I suspect hasn't had a chance to speak to Joseph to tell him about the visit of the angel that's mentioned in Luke's gospel. The New Testament claims that Mary was a virgin, that God gave her this pregnancy. If you want to ask questions about the virgin birth, etc., happy to try and answer that about why I believe it. But you notice verse 25, but he, that's Joseph, her husband, did not consummate their marriage until she gave birth to a son, and he gave him the name Jesus. So after the birth of Jesus, Joseph and Mary have a normal married sexual relationship. In fact, Matthew goes on to say Jesus had four brothers and at least two sisters. Happy to talk about that later on if you like. So that's Mary, and she hadn't told Joseph about this. Then in verse 19, we're told about Joseph, her husband-to-be. Because Joseph, her husband, was faithful to the law and yet did not want to expose her to public disgrace, he had in mind to divorce her quietly. So he's a good man. He wants to be gentle with her. She has apparently been unfaithful to him, but he still wants to be careful and treat her well, but he can't go ahead and marry her on the basis of what he knows. I wonder why he didn't know. It's quite possible she hadn't seen him for months, or she may not have had the words to tell him about what had happened. I can imagine that. But we're told, after he'd considered this, an angel of the Lord appeared to him in a dream and said, "Joseph, son of David, do not be afraid to take Mary home as your wife, because what is conceived in her is from the Holy Spirit." When Joseph woke up, he did what the angel of the Lord had commanded him and took Mary home as his wife. Does anyone know what words Joseph is recorded as saying in the New Testament? Exactly correct. Nothing. He's never recorded as actually saying anything. He's simply, if you like, faithful and obedient. Some might say the perfect husband. And then verse 21, she will give birth to a son and you are to give him the name Jesus because he will save his people from their sins. Jesus is the Greek form of the Hebrew name Joshua or Yeshua, which means the Lord saves. Now, what's interesting is there's all sorts of positives have come from the Christian worldview being put into practice over centuries, like the rise of science, individual rights, the value of humanity, the idea that those in power should serve, political freedom. There's all sorts of things. But primarily, Jesus comes as a rescuer, to rescue people, us, from the consequences of walking away from God. Now, verse 21... she will give birth to a son. Verse 22. Yep. All this took place to fulfill what the Lord had said through the prophet, the virgin will conceive and give birth to a son, and they will call him Emmanuel, which means God with us. Now, Matthew's often quotes from the Old Testament to show how the Old Testament predicted these things. This is a quote from the prophet Isaiah about 8 centuries BC, and the promise that a virgin, a young woman, would bear a son and he'd be known as Emmanuel, God with us. My time is almost gone. Let me read you an article that I found before Christmas. Very good, written by Greg Sheridan, who's a foreign editor for The Australian. He's based in Melbourne. I have no idea whether Greg Sheridan's a Christian. I suspect not from this article. But the article's entitled, It's No Miracle Christmas Survives in the Post-Christian West. You can look it up online if you wish. Let me read this to you. He says, but as our society leaves Christianity behind, it is a painful fact the content of Christianity, and especially the content of Christmas, has all but passed out of collective consciousness. Given that for most of the past 2,000 years, until about 5 minutes ago, Christianity shaped Western civilization, this sheer and willful ignorance, entirely separate from the question of belief, is an extreme version of a perverse kind of intellectual self-harm. For Christmas, as traditionally understood in Western culture, is the most radical event in human history. The claims of the Christian religion, which centre on Christmas, are the most stupendous that have ever been made. One common post-Christian way of understanding Jesus is to think of him as a good and kindly man who provided great moral teaching, a kind of early Mahatma Gandhi, and that others, especially the historical church, have attributed divinity to him that he never claimed himself. The problem is this doesn't accord with the facts at all. Jesus himself, in the Gospels generally, Jesus himself and the Gospels generally constantly claim that Jesus is God. Not a messenger of God, not a teacher inspired by God, not an angel, still less the leader of a social movement, but actually God. No other historical figure who founded a significant religion has ever made this claim. Therefore, as Christians used to point out, there are only three possibilities for Jesus. Either he is a deluded fanaticist, a profoundly brilliant charlatan, or indeed he was, and is, God. One of the best ways to understand the cultural and historical import of Christianity is to actually read the Gospels. It's a novel idea, isn't it? Read the Gospels. There are mysteries in them, but overall they are abundantly clear on all the big points. Jesus claimed a divinity. For example, in John's Gospel, Jesus says, I tell you the truth, before Abraham was, I am. The point of these quotations, and there are many others to the same effect, is not to convince anyone particularly that Christianity is true, but just to make clear the uncompromising nature of the claims Jesus made. Jesus proclaimed that he is God and that, incidentally, God created all the universe. These are the most radical and paradigm-shattering claims ever made in human history. They may be wrong, but it's surely worth knowing something about them. Interesting article. One of the things that fascinates me about the New Testament is this. How did a group of fiercely monotheistic first century Jewish people who fiercely believe that God is one and there's only one God come to believe that this man was God become one of us? How did they come to believe that? Why did they believe it? And why did they believe that it was worth giving their life, everything they had, to follow him? That's the question that Matthew answers, and that's what we'll look at this coming year in Bible Shots. Yep. Did you guys hear? Matthew's written particularly to Jewish people, genealogy is very important. In our culture, the culture I come from, we've kind of lost the significance of that, and it's to our detriment. Yep. So it's logically the right place for him to start. Yep.
So Al, you know, just a question I was wondering. I'm not an Orthodox Jew, and genealogies don't necessarily jump out to me as something that, mean a lot, and the idea of God speaking through dreams also seems a bit strange. What's the guts take home for me?
I think what Matthew has done, what's the take home for Lachlan? I think what Matthew has done is to set the scene and remind us, if we're familiar with the Old Testament, of 2,000 years from Abraham through to Jesus, 2,000 years of history, and particularly how God has kept the promises of the Messiah alive through all of that time. And the idea is that something new is happening as Jesus, the Messiah, the promised one, has arrived. The idea of God speaking through dreams, yes. In the book of Hebrews, when in the New Testament says, in the past, God spoke to us through the prophets and through dreams in various ways. So it's possible that God may do that. But then Hebrews goes on to say the clearest way that God's spoken to us is in the person of Jesus. Mm-hmm. So anything that you... is God speaking to me, etc.? Well, God may. Interesting, one of my teachers said to me once, what's the difference between God spoke to me in a dream and I had a dream that God spoke to me? So it can be a bit hard to... Joseph obviously was sure about it. Okay. So you've got to weigh up what it is that maybe God's saying by what I think is very clear about how God wants us to live in the Bible. Mm-hmm. But God may do that, he just hasn't promised to.
Thanks, Al.
Thoughts, questions? Yep, John.
You said you might tell us about virgin birth, why you believe
that. Okay, the virgin birth, yep. Now, forgive me, the old preacher's joke is some people find the virgin birth inconceivable, right? Okay. just a little chuckle's enough. Why do I believe it? What's interesting is this. The New Testament doesn't seem to build anything on it. So Jesus is born of a virgin, therefore, what? Some people have said, it's the way of breaking the cycle of original sin, that people are born sinful, or I think a more colloquial way to say it, we're born selfish and self-centered, and Jesus is born of a virgin, and that kind of breaks the cycle. It could be right, but I can't think of anywhere where the New Testament says that. I suspect the more likely reason is this, that in the Old Testament there's a whole series of kind of saviour or rescuer figures who are born in unexpected ways and born to women who'd not been able to have children, like Samson and Samuel and then John the Baptist. And so an angel turns up, says to the woman, you haven't been able to have a child, but you'll have a child and he'll be special. Jesus is the most miraculous and special of all. I think that's the best reason I can come up with. Why do I believe it? Well, if someone told me about immaculate conception today, I'd be quite cynical. Or sceptical might be a better word. But when you take the package about Jesus' life, who he is, what he did, I think the fact that he rose again, the evidence is very strong. When you take the whole package and they say, actually, this man was born of a virgin and God's intervened in human history, as a package, it holds water. That's why I believe it. That's a good point. So the Bible promises, Jesus promises, that he will come back one day and bring the judgment day, come back in power and glory. Were we, the first time around, were we expecting a baby? I think the answer is yes. So in Isaiah, and Lachlan will know the exact reference, 9, for unto us a child is born.
96.
Thank you, well done. Yeah, for unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders, and I think Handel's Messiah is all about that. So the expectation is that a child would be born, yes. And for those who had eyes to see it, they call Jesus the Son of David. They know that he'll grow. Ironically, it's the blind beggar in Luke's Gospel who can see that. It's just that they hadn't worked out how the Messiah would rescue people. So, for example, John the Baptist, who was sent to prepare things, he was expecting fire and brimstone and the judgment day. And Jesus kind of identifies with sinners and seeks to forgive them and he's kissing babies and healing people, and John can't work it out. So what the baby did when he grew up is not quite what they'd expected. There's two characters in the Old Testament, if you like. One is the king who would come and rule as God's king and Messiah. The other is a servant who would come and die on behalf of other people. No one had worked out till after the resurrection that they were the same person. So, yes, looking for a baby, it's just no one had worked out quite exactly how the baby would rescue people and bring God's kingdom.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.